twin suicide bombing hits a crowded market in the Iraqi capital, leaving at least 32 people dead and more than 100 wounded. Britain says it'll tighten its border restrictions while the country is grappling with a rising number of coronavirus deaths and infections. German Chancellor defends the decision to extend her country's strict lockdowns until mid-February to slow a more aggressive variant of COVID-19. Welcome to World News here in the Iranian capital. I'm your host, Behzad Zajafi. Good to have you with us. Starting with Iraq, not very good news, of course. Two bomb explosions rock in the center of the Iraqi capital, leaving more than 30 people dead in the first such attack in years. The explosions ripped through a crowded market near Tayaran Square in central Baghdad. According to security sources, two attackers wearing explosive vests blew themselves up among shoppers. Some 110 people were injured. There has been no claim of responsibility. Suicide bombings have been rare in the Iraqi capital since the defeat of the Daesh terrorist group in 2017. Political commentator Ali El-Neshmi says that the Daesh terrorist group is making a resurgence in Iraq, and that's thanks to U.S.-Israeli efforts to weaken the country's popular mobilization units.
There is many injured, more than 100, and the martyrs is more than 30. And no one declared till now about who's behind it. But I think there is many wings or many directions behind that, and especially now the ISILs increasing their action in the Iraq, especially in this period when the government and the Western and American and Israel, they targeted the popular mobilization, and the people now shouting against them, and they listen for this media against the popular mobilization, and there is a policy now from 6 months to reducing or to weakening popular mobilization. Then they used that kind of weakening, and they escaped and come in the central of Baghdad and using the explosive belt.
The UK says it will be tightening its border controls as the country is struggling to contain a new wave of the novel coronavirus. Spokesman for British Prime Minister says that Britain stands ready to strengthen its border policy following a surge in COVID-19 cases and deaths. Boris Johnson is set to impose further restrictions on the public by prohibiting international travel. The UK has seen a record number of COVID deaths, authorities warning the numbers could rise further. The UK reported 39,000 new cases on Wednesday. Its daily death toll has topped 1,500 over the past 3 days. Elsewhere in Europe, German Chancellor Angela Merkel has defended her government's decision to extend national lockdowns until mid-February, and this is amid concerns for a new variant in Europe. News review time. Stay with us. Anti-establishment protesters in the United States have clashed with police and attacked buildings in the cities of Portland and Seattle. Demonstrators protesting President Joe Biden's inauguration vandalized and sprayed graffiti on the Democratic Party of Oregon's office in Portland. Also in Seattle, anti-government ralliers took to the streets, vandalizing multiple sites. Police saying that 8 people were arrested in Portland and 2 in Seattle. Portland has been the scene of unrest for months. The protests began in the summer as part of nationwide demonstrations against racism and police brutality following the killing of unarmed African-American George Floyd by white officers. Now joining me will be a couple of guests, Colin Campbell, our own correspondent in Washington, D.C., and we'll have Nicholas Ayala, editor of the Anticonquista from Newark. Good to have you with us both. Colin, what's going on? I mean, tell us a bit more about who these people are, what they're doing, and what their agenda is.
Yeah, it's kind of confusing as to what their overall agenda is, except that they say they are for anti-imperialism and they are anti-fascist. Now, what's confusing about that is a lot of these activists or rioters, however you would describe them, believe that they were under a fascistic government under the previous president. And it seems that this type of mindset has continued with the current president. In Seattle, 3 arrests were made, 2 for property damage, another for assault, and another 8 in Portland, Oregon. And so what this shows is that there's still a continued movement out there that seems to subvert the established government. Now, again, these aren't the large numbers that we have seen over the past few years, but they still indicate that there are a number of people who still dissent, even with a democratic government, even before they get to see what the government is going to do. And so that's why their message might seem a little bit convoluted, is because they are not really taking any specific action on policies that were just created under the Biden administration, but rather long-standing policies that have come from the U.S. overall.
I see. Nicholas, you tell us about your assessment of what's going on with the situation and why important in Seattle? What's the problem?
Well, I think a lot of it stems from liberals and leftists who were nearly never on the Biden wagon, who never really supported Joe Biden and wanted to see a more progressive candidate or more progressive policies. And a lot of their dissatisfaction comes from the fact that right now, we're in an economic crisis. You have places like Portland and Seattle. One of the places they attacked were Amazon, and Amazon is pretty big in both cities. And so you have an uber concentration of wealth, and the rich getting ultra rich, the rich becoming more and more wealthier. And a lot of these activists see this, and then they see that their own living conditions are either getting worse or stagnating, and they don't really have high expectations for the Biden presidency. So they're coming out against Biden, even though he hasn't, again, we said, he hasn't really done much yet. He hasn't really done anything. And they're expressing their concerns that I think are concerns that really lingered over from the presidential race and from Trump's presidency, and will probably continue to linger even after Biden takes office.
Nicholas, are these people led by any special party or individual? How do they organize themselves? And is this the right way they're making their voices heard?
Well, a lot of it, I would say, is more so spontaneous. I don't think they're really following one leader or following a organization or a party or a group. It's more so, I think, just their general individual dissatisfaction, which forces them onto the street, and they see that there's other individuals who have that similar dissatisfaction, and then it becomes sort of like a mob mentality. If this is the right way to actually go about it, well, you know, I don't think that they're going to be influencing or changing any sort of policy. If anything, I know about a month back, the Portland mayor came out and said that he wants to crack down on these mobs and crack down on these rioters, specifically citing the anti-fascist protesters. So I think, if anything, they might be doing more of a disservice to themselves at the end of the day. They might actually be calling for more. They're actually maybe causing more police to come in and crack down on them, mostly because they have no organized plan.
Right. Now back to D.C. Colin, I just want to ask you a quick question. That is, because we said that this is all started after George Floyd's death. So was that the main reason, or was this a spark?
I think that was a spark. There's always been an anti-fascist movement in the U.S. for years, stemming from World War II. So this is just a resurgence of it. We've seen even parts of it in the Occupy movement before that. So again, seeing what happened with George Floyd was a reason for them to re-energize and talk about a police state, talking about fascism, and to protest against that. But again, with this new administration, I'm not saying that there aren't going to be elements of aggressive policing and militarized policing, but we just haven't seen that. You know, this new administration has not even been in power for 48 hours yet, so it's very strange for them to lash out in this way.
Okay, thank you very much for your contribution and comments. We had our own correspondent in D.C., Dr. Colin Campbell, and also Nicholas Ayala, editor of the Anticonquista from Newark. Let's move on with the rest of this news broadcast. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas is urging the U.S.'s newly sworn in president to start a new political path and correct the historical mistakes that Washington committed against Palestinians.
We hope that the new U.S. administration headed by Joe Biden will start a new political path in the region and correct the historical mistakes it committed against our Palestinian people, its denial of our rights, and its standing by the occupation and covering up for it in order to continue denying our rights and aggression against our Palestinian people.
The Hamas spokesman also urged the United States to stop efforts to force the countries in West Asia to normalize relations with the Israeli regime. He was referring to normalization agreements signed by Tel Aviv and several Arab states during Trump's presidency. Bahrain and the UAE signed Washington-sponsored deals in September, and that drew condemnation from the Muslim world, Palestinians calling it a stab in the back. Then came Sudan and Morocco. They were the next Arab states agreeing to normalize ties with Israel, and despite popular opposition at home. Now, Beijing says its sanctions against 28 former U.S. officials over alleged violations of Chinese sovereignty are justified and necessary.
Over the past few years, some anti-China politicians in the United States, out of their selfish political interests and prejudice and hatred against China, have planned, promoted, and executed the crazy moves which have gravely interfered in China's internal affairs, undermined China's interests, offended the Chinese people, and seriously damaged China-U.S. relations.
The Chinese Foreign Ministry says the reciprocal sanctions demonstrate Beijing's determination to safeguard its national interests. The measures ban allies of the former U.S. president and their families from entering mainland China, Hong Kong, and the Macau Autonomous Region. Companies associated with them are also banned from doing business with China. Those sanctioned include former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and former National Security Advisor John Bolton. The Chinese foreign minister says the blacklist includes anti-China politicians who have displayed hatred and selfish political interests and prejudice toward the country. The Iranian foreign minister is warning the new U.S. president of Israeli plots to push Washington into confrontation with the Islamic Republic. In a tweet, Mohammed Javad it said that the Israeli prime minister aimed to trap another U.S. president into spending American blood and treasure to confront Iran. Sadiq also ambassador Netanyahu's congratulatory message to Biden, in which he urged the newly sworn-in president to work with Israel to confront what are called the Iran threat. Zarif called the message bootlicking and cringeworthy obsequiousness, stressing that such desperate plotting against Iran will fail. Israel's call for an anti-Iran stance follows Biden's remarks about a conditional return to the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. A convoy carrying supplies to U.S. forces in Iraq has come under attack in the capital, Baghdad. Iraqi media saying that a convoy was hit by a bomb explosion in Baghdad's Abu Ghraib area. One U.S. military personnel was reportedly injured in that blast. U.S. forces and their supply convoys have repeatedly come under attack in Iraq in the past months, and this is amid growing anti-Washington sentiments. The U.S. has sparked an outrage by assassinating top Iranian General Soleimani and senior commander of Iraqi Popular Mobilization Units, Abu Mahdi al-Mohandes, near Baghdad in January 2020. In a creative initiative to bring to light Iranian dignitaries, a national airliner has named each one of its planes after a renowned character in Iran's history. Youssef Jalali has the story.
This plane belongs to the Iran Air Tour airliner. From now on, it has a name, Mir Emad Hassani. Mir Emad is perhaps the most important figure in the history of Persian calligraphy. The measure comes as part of an initiative to name 10 jets after outstanding dignitaries in the history of art, literature, and science in Iran. The move took effect following an agreement signed between the Iranian Commission of UNESCO and Iran Air Tour.
Iran Air Tour is proud to fulfill its duty and name each aircraft in its fleet after a dignitary in Iran's history. This is done under the agreement signed with the National Commission of UNESCO to pay respect to our dignitaries and keep their memories alive.
Mir Emad plane made its debut flight under the new name from Tehran to Mashhad. Mir Emad Hassani lived in the 16th century, and his legacy in the Persian Nastali writing style is recognized by Persian calligraphers around the world.
When a young Iranian wants to get on the plane, they see a dignitary's name on the plane. This makes them curious about that figure. Inside the plane, they could find brochures providing information about that character. I think this is a creative initiative to introduce our great figures like Mir Emad, Shams, Maulana Rumi, Hafez, and Saadi to the new generation.
Experts say history is a nation's identity. Iranian artists say in the modern world, it's important to keep the names of well-known personalities alive and introduce them to the next generation in order to preserve the Persian identity.
Cultural officials here say amid the exponential technological advances, societies are losing their touch with art and culture. Now decorating airplanes with the names of renowned dignitaries is viewed as a creative step toward reuniting modern communities with their rich history. Yusuf Jalali from the holy city of Mashhad.
An open grave and a wailing father awaiting his only son's dead body in Indian-controlled Kashmir. The 16-year-old son was killed along with two other youths by Indian forces last month. Authorities have buried the dead some 150 kilometers from their hometown, fearing a large-scale protest and the spread of coronavirus during funeral processions. Our correspondent has a report.
Since the onset of a global pandemic, the authorities in Indian-controlled Kashmir have denied lost rights to the families of those killed during gun battles. Authorities say the fear of virus spread and to avoid law and order issues, such steps are taken. 16-year-old Atharvani, Ejaz Makbul and Zubair Lone, killed during 2020's lost gun battle, were no exception to this new ritual of distant burial. The family of the three youths deny government claims and accuse the authorities of dubbing them as fighters. We visited Atharvani's family living in the southern district of Pulwama.
He was not a militant. I am his mother. Why didn't they inform us when he was trapped? In other cases, they call the parents on site to ask their children to surrender. Why did they call me after killing him?
Athar's father has repeatedly asked authorities to return his son's dead body, and in this waiting process, he has dug a grave in his ancestral graveyard. Both father and the grave are now waiting. Authorities have denied his demands, fearing protests in this fragile region. Analysts say these funeral processions were the only means through which people would give vent to their sentiment.
The dead bodies and funerals, they had become instruments of huge mobilizations, and they could do nothing about it because international humanitarian law, Geneva Conventions, provide that dead bodies have to be given to the families.
Earlier in June 2020, three civilians were killed in a staged gun battle in Kashmir and dubbed as foreign militants by an Indian army captain to lure cash rewards. Following the incident, people of Kashmir now fear for the safety of their young ones.
Analysts say Kashmir authorities' denial to return the dead bodies of local fighters to their families is a clear violation of Geneva Conventions, to which India is a signatory. The move is seen as a pretext for suppressing the anti-India sentiments that become prominent during such funerals. Shahana Butt, Indian Administrator, Kashmir.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable Discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Outgoing Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell made his most definitive break yet with President Donald Trump on Tuesday, 19th of January, while the leader of the incoming Democratic Majority laid out an ambitious agenda for the opening weeks of the Biden administration, signaling a dizzying changing of the guard in Washington. The article you're about to hear has been written by the Washington Post journalists Mike DeBonis and Paul Kane. The piece is titled "Uncertainty Reigns in Senate as Schumer Pushes Past Agenda and McConnell Calls Out Trump." Stay with us for more of Mike DeBonis and Paul Kane's article. Outgoing Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell made his most definitive break yet with President Donald Trump on Tuesday, 19th of January, while the leader of the incoming Democratic Majority laid out an ambitious agenda for the opening weeks of the Biden administration, signaling a dizzying changing of the guards in Washington. Mitch McConnell, a Republican from Kentucky, for the first time directly blamed Donald Trump for the lethal 6th of January assault on the Capitol. "The mob was fed lies," he said in his final floor speech, closing out 6 years as majority leader. "They were provoked by the president and other powerful people." Senator Charles Schumer, a Democrat from New York, outlined a rapid-fire agenda for the coming weeks that includes confirming Joe Biden's cabinet nominees, approving trillions of dollars in additional pandemic aid, and barring Trump from holding office, despite an uncertain roadmap in the 50-50 Senate, which is struggling even to adopt its basic rules. Senator Charles Schumer is set to move from minority leader to majority leader on Wednesday, when the Senate meets shortly after the inauguration of Joe Biden and Vice President-elect Kamala Harris, who will tip the chamber towards Democrats with her tie-breaking vote. "The next several months will be very, very busy and a very consequential period for the United States Senate," Schumer said on the Senate floor. "Let us begin our work in earnest." Significant obstacles threaten each of Schumer's early goals. Republicans have thrown up early roadblocks to some of Joe Biden's key nominees. GOP fiscal concerns could make a bipartisan coronavirus bill difficult to pass, and Trump's impeachment trial threatens to consume the earliest days of the Senate Democratic majority. Beyond that, Schumer and McConnell reached an impasse on Tuesday, 19th of January, in talks to set the open operating rules of the equally divided Senate, making any action a challenge. As Mitch McConnell demanded that Democrats drop any notion of ending the legislative filibuster, McConnell also seized the opportunity to make at least a rhetorical break with Donald Trump at a moment when the consequences are relatively low, with Trump leaving office and the benefits potentially high, possibly winning back donors turned off by Donald Trump's actions. Most of Mitch McConnell's fellow Senate Republicans, however, showed little sign of following suit. Many must still contend with a GOP base that is supportive of Trump, and they could pay a price for denouncing him too forcefully, suggesting the party could face a years-long struggle between those embracing Trump and those distancing themselves. It would take two-thirds of the Senate to convict Donald Trump and bar him from future office, so Republican senators would need to supply 17 votes if all Democrats vote against Trump. Even McConnell did not say whether Trump should be convicted. Senator Joni Ernst, a Republican from Iowa, a member of Mitch McConnell's leadership team who just secured a second six-year term, joined a growing group of Republicans arguing that it would be unconstitutional to try Donald Trump after he leaves office, a position that is challenged by some constitutional scholars, but embraced by GOP office holders as they struggle to square Trump's conduct with his popularity among Republican voters. He's not our president after tomorrow, Senator Joni Ernst said, accusing Democrats of wanting to further divide the nation with a Senate trial. We need to start healing. I don't think this does that. Senator Lindsey Graham, a Republican from South Carolina, who has been among a small group of Republicans counseling Donald Trump since the 6th of January riot, said convicting Trump after he leaves the presidency is bad for the presidency and it's bad for the country. But Senator Schumer said Trump's actions, which included repeating baseless claims of a stolen election, calling his supporters to gather in Washington on the day of the electoral vote certification, and then sending them towards the Capitol building as the proceedings got underway, deserved the gravest possible reprimand under America's Constitution. After what he has done, the consequences of which we're all witness to, Donald Trump should not be eligible to run for office ever again, Charles Schumer said. All of us want to put this awful chapter in our nation's history behind us, but healing and unity will only come if there is truth and accountability, not sweeping such a severe charge and such awful actions under the rug. The push for accountability could impinge on the other items on the Democratic to-do list. A presidential impeachment trial has historically been an all-consuming affair for the Senate, impeding virtually all other significant business, and previous trials have lasted several weeks. Donald Trump's first trial in the Senate concluded last February and lasted for 21 days. While some Democratic senators have floated a much shorter trial this time around, the House impeachment managers who act as prosecutors could feel compelled to present witnesses and evidence elucidating the president's role in the violence, as well as legal arguments rebutting the claim that former officials cannot be convicted. The impeachment resolution passed last week in the House of Representatives holds that Trump warrants disqualification to hold and enjoy any office of honor, trust, or profit under the United States, language found in the Constitution relating to those who foster insurrection. Senator Richard Durbin, a Democrat from Illinois, the number two Democratic leader, said balancing the trial with the other pillars of the Biden agenda would depend on a level of cooperation with Republicans. We need to get President Biden, his team, he said. America is in a terrible situation with this pandemic. We have issues of national security that are still in front of us. We have an economy that's struggling. All of those things are high priorities. Looming over all of the incoming business in the Senate is the unfinished negotiation between Mitch McConnell and Charles Schumer about precisely how a 50-50 Senate will operate. Both leaders are eyeing the rules from the last evenly split Senate in 2001 as a template. Republicans and Democrats agreed then that the party holding the White House, and therefore the vice presidency, would set the floor agenda and chair committees, while the panels themselves would be evenly split. Mitch McConnell, however, threw a new wrinkle into the negotiations, seeking assurances from Schumer that Democrats would swear off any attempt at abolishing the 60-vote threshold for cutting off debate on legislation, something liberal activists have been demanding for years. McConnell's spokesman, Doug Andreas, confirmed the filibuster demand remains an unsettled issue. Discussions on all aspects of the power-sharing agreement will continue over the next several days, he said. Charles Schumer's spokesman, Justin Goodman, said the Democratic leader's view is that the fairest, most reasonable, and easiest path forward is to adopt the 2001 bipartisan agreement without extraneous changes from either side. Mitch McConnell and Charles Schumer emerged from a 30-minute meeting reporting no real progress, and some advisers suggested no deal could be struck this week. The impasse, according to multiple Senate aides, could mean that Joe Biden finishes at least his first day in office without any cabinet members being confirmed, a highly unusual circumstance in recent history. Speaking on the floor on Tuesday, 19th of January, Mitch McConnell sent a signal to Democrats by asserting that Joe Biden enters office without a mandate for sweeping ideological change, given the narrow majorities in the House and the Senate, and Biden's platform as a presidential candidate who said he'd represent everyone. Until negotiations over the Senate procedures are resolved, many of Joe Biden's cabinet selections could linger in limbo. Committees will be unable to formally process nominees and send them to the full Senate, and the only path for a nominee would be if all 100 senators agreed to move the selection directly onto the Senate floor. Several Senate committees held hearings on Tuesday, 19th of January, with Biden nominees, including his picks to lead the Departments of Defense, Homeland Security, Department of State, and Treasury, as well as his choice for Director of National Intelligence. One roadblock emerged on Tuesday from Republican Senator Josh Hawley, who announced he would object to any effort to advance Alejandro N. Mayorkas, Joe Biden's pick for Homeland Security Secretary, to the Senate floor. In a statement, Josh Hawley cited Biden's immigration platform, which includes creating a path to citizenship for millions of undocumented immigrants. Mr. Mayorkas has not adequately explained how he will enforce federal laws and secure the southern border, given President-elect Joe Biden's promise to roll back major enforcement and security measures, said Hawley, who came under fire for contesting the Electoral College count even after the mob ransacked the Capitol building. Meanwhile, the incoming chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Senator Robert Menendez, a Democrat from New Jersey, said Anthony Blinken, Joe Biden's nominee for Secretary of State, would not get a panel vote until next week. And Senate action on Joe Biden's choice for Defense Secretary, retired General Lloyd Austin, is in limbo due to the need for a congressional waiver of the federal law requiring that former military officials must wait at least 7 years before they can become Defense Secretary. Some Senate aides on Tuesday expressed hope that Janet Yellen, Joe Biden's nominee for Treasury Secretary, and Avril Haines, Biden's nominee for Director of National Intelligence, could win confirmation on Wednesday.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Today's lesson, neither flattery nor envy. Undoubtedly, the worthy individuals and their good attributes and deeds should be praised and appreciated. And in this way, we shall encourage and support them to carry on with their good work. But praise should be proportionate to the merit. Otherwise, it would have negative and harmful consequences. If it is more than merit, it becomes flattery, which hurts the dignity of the speaker and also causes self-conceit and self-admiration in the one who is being flattered. And if it is less than merit, it discourages the good doers and shows that the speaker is either envious or weak in his power of expression. Right? So if you do not praise someone where they deserve to be praised, it's most likely, or you know, a good chance is that it is because you are envious. And similarly, if you praise someone where they do not deserve to be praised, this means you are just appeasing to that person. You're just trying to make that person happy without the right reasons, right? And you're doing flattery. Now, this flattery is not only not healthy for you, but also it's not healthy for the recipient, because then that person starts to live a life of conceit, and that person starts to feel something that he is not really in reality, right? So this is why neither flattery nor envy is the way to go. Welcome back to your listeners. Today we are discussing neither flattery nor envy. We have seen people flattering other people sometimes, and then at the same time we have seen people who are envious of others and hence never praises them. Now both of these extremes are not appreciated and encouraged in Islam. Islam discourages these two traits. So a mu'min, a believer, a Muslim, should neither flatter other believers, nor should they be envious about this other party and never praise them, right? Wherever somebody deserves to be praised, you should praise them. This is what justice calls you towards. And wherever the other person does not deserve to be praised, you should not praise them. But remember that it should not be like this, that you're envious of someone and hence you do not praise them. This is against the Islamic ethos. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the first infallible Imam, says, when praise and commendation is more than merited and deserved, it is flattery. And when less than merited, it is either debility in expression or envy. Now, flattery is common in the society we live in, unfortunately. And I think it won't be a wrong statement to say that envy is even more common. Now, these two are the diseases, ethical and moral diseases, that sometimes, afflict upon a believer, and they get attached and associated to a believer. Remember, both of these extremes are bad and discouraged in Islam. So neither flattery nor envy. Thank you.
dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
According to figures from human rights observers, a non-profit that monitors police evictions in northern France, there were 973 evictions in Calais in 2020, nearly three a day, and more than double the 452 recorded in 2018. In December alone, 526 tents were seized and 41 arrests were made. Isabella Anderson, a human rights observer field coordinator, said, "It's been like this for months." She added, "These constant evictions are part of a policy by the French government to wear down asylum seekers, to fatigue them and take away their hope. It's like torture." I prepared for you an article written by Peter Young. The piece is titled, "Like Torture, French Police Accused of Continued Migrant Rights Abuses." The article has been taken from the British newspaper The Guardian. Please stay with us for more of Peter Young's article. Shortly before sunrise on 9th of January, about 40 officers and officials gathered outside the police station in Calais in northern France as temperatures dipped to minus 3 degrees Celsius. Shortly after, in a well-drilled procedure, a nine-vehicle convoy started down the road towards the first of five forced evictions of makeshift refugee camps planned for that morning. When the convoy arrived at the camp just a few miles from the city center, masked police officers in black uniforms chased refugees away from their tents and belongings. Some of the other 150 refugees who had been sheltering at the camp had already packed and fled before authorities arrived. Soon the camp was empty. Frost covered sleeping bags and jackets were all that remained. According to figures from Human Rights Observers, a non-profit that monitors police evictions in northern France, there were 973 evictions in Calais in 2020, nearly three a day, and more than double the 452 recorded in 2018. In December alone, for example, 526 tents were seized and 41 arrests were made. Isabella Anderson, a human rights observer's field coordinator, said, "It's been like this for months." She added, "The constant evictions are part of a policy by the French government to wear down asylum seekers, to fatigue them and take away their hope. It's like torture." Although at several eviction sites, The Guardian was blocked by a perimeter of police, video evidence and first-hand documents showed what campaigners claimed are persistent human rights violations during police operations, including excessive use of force and destruction of personal property. Reported cases of police violence have included minors being tear-gassed, a tent with a refugee inside being dragged by a tractor, and an Eritrean man shot in the face with a rubber bullet from 10 meters away, hospitalizing him for 2 months. The evictions by French police were on a rolling 48-hour schedule to prevent refugees acquiring limited rights and the police requiring a court order to clear the land. Abdul, a 20-year-old from Sudan who has been in Calais for 5 months, camping in the bushes in the hope of one day crossing to the United Kingdom by boat or lorry, said, "They come at 5 a.m. local time, circle around your tent and cut it with knives." He added, "It has happened to me so many times. They treat us like animals, not humans. In Sudan there is war, people are killed, women are raped, but in some ways it is better than here." Nasser, an Afghan refugee who turned 18 in December, said the constant evictions had affected his mental health. He said, "The police keep coming. You would think maybe if it is raining, they would not come, but they do. They even came on New Year's Day when everyone was happy and it was a holiday. They take our stuff and we have to be outside for many hours, sometimes up to 10 to 12 hours. They don't care if I'm a minor." Most evictions are carried out using flagrants, a measure which allows police to remove occupants of private land if there has been a complaint and they have been there for less than 48 hours. Some lead to arrests and deportations, but often refugees flee and later return. Lawyers say the evictions are harassment and a breach of United Nations and French human rights laws. With the emergency measure intended for gathering facts about a crime deployed wrongly and permanently. Margot Sifra, who specializes in evictions for legal support charity Cabane Juridique, said, "It is a complete abuse of the system." She added, "Under normal circumstances, an eviction requires the authorization of a judge, a social diagnosis to identify vulnerable people, and preparation to provide rehousing solutions. But under flagrants, which should be a short-term measure, there is no legal basis and no opportunity to appeal." Bastien Roland, a lawyer working in Calais, said the tactics were deliberately vague and difficult to contest. Bastien Roland added, "The government spends millions of euros to slow these refugees down. They will still try to cross to England, but with how many traumas?" Larger-scale evictions, described as sheltering operations, involving the dispersal of refugees to centers around the country, are carried out by French authorities through court orders. On 29th of September, for example, nearly 800 people were evicted in an area known as Hospital, one of 15 such operations last year. After the destruction of the Calais jungle camp in 2016, another large makeshift camp last September, the evictions are seen by the French authorities as a key weapon in preventing similar fixing points being established by the estimated 1,200 refugees now in Calais and Dunkirk, which includes pregnant women and children. Humanitarian groups working in northern France say that in recent months conditions have worsened and that the evictions have become relentless. About 150 people now sleep under the bridges in Calais city center, where charities are banned from distributing food. But on 24th of December, an order for eviction was granted by the administrative court in Lille, which is expected to take place imminently. Mohamed, a 17-year-old Algeria national currently sleeping under the Molyem Bridge, said, "I don't know what I will do if they evict us." He added, "The strategy is to weaken us, but if everything was fine in our countries, we wouldn't have left our countries. We don't have the choice." The prefecture of Pas-de-Calais said in a statement that the evictions put an end to illegal occupations with a twofold objective: to prevent the reconstitution of insalubrious camps and to provide shelter for migrant population. It claimed the action of the police during these operations responds to strict rules of ethics.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies: 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The reason why the Islamic Republic is opposed to negotiating with the U.S.
This is part of a televised speech delivered on July 31, 2020 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the supreme leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of Eid al-Adha.
The cure for sanctions is only and solely reliance on national capabilities. We should preserve every capability that we have in this respect, and we should be after discovering new capabilities, bearing in mind that we certainly have many capabilities. Then we should rely on and revive them. We should bring our youth to the arena and pursue the main pillars of the economy of resistance, growth from the inside and working with the outside. We have both domestic and international capabilities. We are capable of producing inside the country in a way that various scientific, economic, and other such capabilities will start to bubble up. And we are also capable of working at an international level. We have good friends with whom we can work. This requires effort and diligence.
Your light and love, all I see. Nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
The economy of resistance includes both growth from inside and working with the outside. And in both areas, we have numerous resources which we can benefit from. Our capacities are really infinite. The more we move forward, the more capacities will show up. Of course, these things will be acquired with the jihadi management. They are achieved with real acumen and jihadi management. We have influential friends in the world. Of course, it is not the case that we get dependent on our friendly governments. This is not the case. Our reliance is on Allah the Exalted and on ourselves. Even if we did not have powerful friends in the world, we would do our job and we would move forward.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah. All praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah. All praises to Allah, all praises to
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.